Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Saturday, July 26th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Who Will Roll Away the Stones? Stories of Closure, Healing, and Resurrection in Palestine and Israel. Session 5 of Roadmaps and Detours, Stories and Images from 5 Years in the Holy Land, presented by Susan and Michael Thomas. Number THM 2003-10. Let's listen in.
Redeemer in the old city of Jerusalem for 5 years, from 1998 until this end of June. I have returned a year ago, or in September, to the United States to begin a co-pastorate there that we are sharing. Michael returned with our oldest son, who was finishing high school now at the end of June. So I actually was there for 4 years, and he for 5. We're now entering a new ministry at the Lutheran Church, Our Savior Lutheran Church in Hanover, New Hampshire, which is a congregation that also has a campus ministry at Dartmouth College. And we feel very fortunate to be doing that, but we also have a lot of heartache over leaving Jerusalem. We were not quite ready to do that, but we hope that we will be returning maybe someday with people like you as we go back and forth a bit.
Well, what we're going to do today, once again, we've been thwarted by technology and the video that we had hoped to be able to show you. We won't be able to do that. It was entitled Visit to Mike's Place, and it gave a perspective from the point of view of an Israeli barkeeper, bar owner, who, perhaps surprisingly, but perhaps not, was one of the people that was working to respond in a small and modest way to the question, who will roll away the stone? What will make for more peace and justice in the Holy Land? And Mike's Place is on the beachfront in Tel Aviv. I'm not going to tell you what the whole video is about, but we had little videos each day, and we're sorry that they didn't work out. But Mike had a bar, open front beach bar, next to the American Embassy. And in May, there was a suicide bombing done by a Briton, Muslim Briton, and another friend of his who died in the sea because he ran away and evidently tried to swim out to sea and died. And they killed several people, and including the security guard. Every cafe and restaurant in Israel has a security guard. That's mandated, and it's essential, except that on the east side of Jerusalem, the side that we lived on, they did not have security guards. I don't know if they were exempt, but there was no need. And so you asked about the question of what are the statistical probabilities or actuarial realities of being injured, wounded, or killed in a terrorist or for that matter, a state Israeli terrorist attack. And on the east side, it's very, very low. And that's one of the things that we told our relatives and friends who were concerned about us and visitors that were coming, that on the east side, you don't have to worry about a bombing. And that doesn't mean that there's anything not to feel less deeply mournful about, but it means that you're not going to be, when you go into a restaurant on the east side, you don't have to worry about a terrorist coming in and blowing himself up.
The whole old city counts as east side?
No. If you were in the Jewish quarter, you would have to worry, and there would be also security. Yeah. There's a lot of security in the Jewish quarter.
Now, what is the east side again?
That's the part of the city that is basically Palestinian, where the Palestinians live. Mm-hmm. And is where the border would have been prior to 1967 that Jordan controlled, that section of the city.
That's what I thought, but I couldn't put that in words.
Okay. those who were working with Palestinians or those who were Palestinian. We also had some crossover with Israelis, particularly rabbis that were committed to human rights within Israel and who were in some capacity sympathetic to what was happening for all of this land and what this was going to mean for the future of Israel itself as a state. And one of the other things that you would have seen on this video is people who have made hard decisions, both people who are just sort of generally thinking, well, why can't we all just live together? You know, like many of us would think, why do we have to have this? Why can't we just all share this land together? And those who have served in the military, even for, there's one man who was on the video who spoke about being in the Israeli Defense Forces for 10 years, and who had come to the decision that he, for the sake of the justice and the humiliation that was being propounded upon the Palestinian people in his role as a soldier in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, and also, interestingly, for the sake of the future of Israel. He said, I love the military, I love the state of Israel, but it took me 10 years to realize that I was assisting the demise of this whole dream by continuing the occupation in the West Bank, and that the occupation was going to have to end. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank areas was going to have to end for Israel to ever be secure and to ever be viable.
And that parallels or mirrors what, in part, what our message is to North American Christians, that because there are somewhere around 25 million Christians in the United States that would identify themselves as evangelicals, fundamentalists, or Christian Zionists, those who particularly support Israel, the state of Israel. And then there's, of course, a large number of Christians that rejoice that the Jews have a homeland, that I would like to say for where they are safe, but actually Jews are in more danger in Israel than they are anywhere else in the world. But that if the state of Israel is going to thrive, it's going to continue, it needs to have a kind of tough love. Many people are saying that. And probably the party that can convey that message most adequately is the United States of America. And we have sort of encouraged it's a kind of addiction to violence. We're like the parents who support the teenager in an addiction, as we think we're helping that person. And that is what the United States has done. And so one of our messages today is that the United States governmental policy has to change, not because, I mean, I think there are strong reasons to support the emergence of a Palestinian state, but because we want the state of Israel to thrive, to be a democracy, to be a beacon of hope. And so you can sort of lay aside, if your sympathies are not perhaps with the Palestinians, you can think in terms of what will help, what will nurture Israeli society most. We're going to show some pictures now from our congregation, from our time in the Holy Land, that I hope will give you a little eye view, bird's eye view of what our ministry was about, and some of the people that are assisting in that sort of gradual rolling away of the stone. I was just reading a book recently about life in the desert, and there's a fascinating image in connection with who will roll away the stone, which of course is from the New Testament. How will, in a sense, resurrection happen when there's such weight, such gravity holding us back? This is a story in the desert that I think near Death Valley. There are these large stones. Now, in the book, the stones were described as several hundred pounds, and I find that hard to believe, but they were heavy stones in any case, and it was on a kind of mud track. So if you were walking on that, your footprints would remain until the next hard wind. And hard winds do come through, and they actually, this is what was in the book, they blow the stones over a period of time. And you can see what they're called mud tracks. You can see how they're called moving stones. You can see, in fact, that they have moved over a period of time because they have wind sometimes well in excess of 100 miles an hour. Now, that seems hard for me to believe, but I take it that the author is telling the truth. And that's an image, then, that what may seem impossible for us, I'm not suggesting through natural forces, but through the power of God to evoke a mission of peace and justice, that stones that are also weighty can move, and seemingly we shake our heads in disbelief, but also in wonderment. So we're going to begin a few of the slides, and I'm going to have to bow out in a few minutes. So you'll just push this one. But we'll go back. We'll go back to this. So I just wanted to... This is just a picture of an altar that children in our congregation decorated 3 years ago at a retreat that we had at a place that means oasis in both Hebrew and Arabic, and it's a community of both Arabs. When I say Arabs, what I'm referring to are Palestinians that are called Arabs in Israel. They are Israeli citizens. Now I think probably the term that's more often used is Palestinian Israelis. And so this is a kibbutz that has both Arabs and Jews, Palestinians and Jews, that live together, that speak each other's languages, that have schools that are bilingual, and it's a great place of hope. And it's just inside the Green Line. It's only about half an hour from the airport, the major airport in Israel. And we had lots of kids at one time in the congregation. And just to give you an indication of the kind of change, we went from sometimes we would have Sunday school with 23, 24 children. And now there are really virtually no children. I think there are two children of one Mennonite couple. And that is really it. We confirmed a group of eight 2 years ago, and they are all gone. Every one of those children, some were Palestinian, and some were internationals, but in any case, they're all gone.
Why are they gone?
For the Palestinians, they couldn't take it anymore. Palestinian Christians tend to be middle class and educated. They tend to have relatives in all parts of the world, and they have resources that they can use to secure green cards, passports. I mean, I'm referring to legal resources, financial resources. And so I could tell you story after story about that. But we had one acquaintance who ran the local grocery store we shopped at. It was one-fifth the size of this lower room. And he wasn't making a go of it in the grocery store. He had a sister who lived in the United States. And over a period of years, through visiting her, he managed to secure a U.S. passport without any kind of great financial resources. And the thing that he told me that I'd like to leave you with is that this was last summer that he finally got the passport after years of working. Last spring 2002 was an extremely difficult year, both for Israelis and for Palestinians, in terms of terrorism, bombings, incursions, destruction of human life. And so there were a lot of curfews and closures that you couldn't get anywhere in the West Bank, which is the part of Palestinian territory that's west of the River Jordan, hence the name West Bank. And so he told me he's been to the United States in the last 2 years, so this is 2002, more often than he's been to his hometown, Ramallah, which is 9 miles away. That's That is really...
In other words, they want to get out of there because they can't make a go of it.
Well, they can't either financially, or it is painful for them to have their children see them humiliated by Israeli soldiers and civil servants in virtually all aspects of their life. Another story. This is not stories about who will roll away the stone, but it lays the scene. We had a good friend, Johnny Rizek and Suhaila Rizek, and one of their children was confirmed. They were well-to-do, educated, middle-class Palestinians, educated in the United States. They had green cards through a long story. A great-grandmother had gone to Panama, I think when the Panama Canal was being built, when it was under U.S. control. She had secured, as a grandmother, she had secured a green card, and then when they moved back to Palestine, they lost the green card. But her children, under U.S. law, cannot have the green card taken away from them without due process. And so Suhaila, who was going to the University of Minnesota in an MBA program, was able to re-secure that green card. That is a card of gold. That's a platinum card. Johnny started out as a very humble garage and became the Volkswagen dealership in East Jerusalem. When the Intifada started, business declined dramatically. Israelis, the major Volkswagen importer to Israel, would no longer deliver to East Jerusalem, and the business declined further, and he didn't know what he was going to do. There were people in San Diego who were saying, come here, start a business here, and so on. But he wanted to stay. Suhaila wanted to stay. They really are people of the land. Johnny, with the Lutheran World Federation at Augusta, Victoria, there's a little bit about it upstairs, they had this wonderful idea at the vocational school that we, if you're Lutheran, we help support, that has auto mechanics, carpentry, computers, etc. Had the idea that this is just before the Intifada started in September 2000. They had the idea that they would do minor repairs at the garage, which didn't have a lot of space, and they would do the major repairs at the Lutheran Vocational School, which would enable students there to really learn about auto mechanics, and the cars could be competently repaired with trained mechanics who were teachers. It was a wonderful idea, and Lutheran World Federation was very interested in that idea. But as then the Intifada came, and so rolling checkpoints developed, and so Johnny could no longer drive to the vocational school, which is within Jerusalem, because there was a checkpoint. So here he told me one story where the soldier wouldn't allow him to drive up to the school and told him to park there and walk up. And he was humiliated by the soldiers and in front of his children. And you can only have that happen so much before you decide, I could stay, but I'm not going to raise my children in this kind of society. That diminishes me and so many others like me. And so they left for California. That's one story among many. Yes?
Did you find, here and there, Israeli military that were sympathetic?
Because
I read something in the paper last year, a number of defections from the Israeli military.
Yeah.
I think they reached 200 and would refuse to fight.
I think that's about right. Yeah, that's right. I think before he came in, I had told a story about a soldier who had decided that
I did hear that.
And he was what they call a refusenik, and there are about that number that have refused at this point.
I want to just give you the context. We live on the Mount of Olives in East Jerusalem, and overlooking the old city, and it was a glorious view. It was a glorious view, and it was a kind of little resurrection.
Is the tower of your church visible in this?
No. Perhaps we'll see it. And that's the Dome of the Rock, which has an ancient history of both within a Muslim and Jewish tradition. There's a sense that that's the center of the earth. There's a rock, there's a huge boulder that has sort of a little room underneath, and it's where Isaac was going to be sacrificed. And so it's not a mosque, but it's a kind of shrine. And it's really, it's one of the most beautiful and perfect buildings in the world. If I click hard enough.
Wait, your turn, Mike.
What? Yeah. Oh.
I turned.
Oh, okay. Maybe it turned twice. And one of the important things about our ministry is that we work very closely, and our successor will work even more closely, and will be actually part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, which is to say the Palestinian Lutheran Church. And this is the bishop, a gifted, creative communicator, Bishop Amin Yunan, educated in Finland. So he learned Arabic, of course, as his mother tongue, and then he went to Finland, where he spent 8 years, and he had to learn Finnish, which is an extraordinarily difficult language, perhaps even more difficult than Arabic. And was educated there and came back and served as a pastor for many years in Ramallah and Beit Jala, which is a small town adjacent to Bethlehem. And this is part of the Sunday school. I forget what the occasion was, probably talking about baptism. And part of the congregation, every year we have this large farewell and Godspeed because so many people were leaving every year.
It used to be that, you know, that everybody would, there would be this kind of rotation, people in and people out. People would come for terms, international people would come for terms of 2 years, 3 years, and maybe would extend. Or they'd be there for a semester, or they'd be there for a year to study, or those kinds of things. And our English-speaking congregation served mostly international people. So now what's happened is that people have left, and the people coming in are not in quite the same regular turnover as the others. And most of the people coming in now are working with direct relief rather than development,
emergency relief. In fact, the United States is largely funding, along with the European Union and Japan and some other countries. This is just an example. This is taken year 2000. And it was a gathering of some of our friends who were part of the church. This man is studying chemical engineering from Gaza. He's studying in France now. She is French. She's a historian. He's a Chinese scholar, translated for the Chinese when a delegation from China came to Israel a few years ago. She is from, they're both from Australia, excuse me. This is Susan and me, of course, and then a couple from Finland. He was an associate of ours, a Lutheran pastor. And I used to show these slides when we would give similar talks and say, they've all left except for us. And now we've all left. And this is a farewell and Godspeed from a few weeks ago. On Augusta Victoria grounds on the Mount of Olives, saying goodbye to people. In our congregation, when we came, there were maybe 60, and the number increased because of the emphasis by various governments and NGOs on Palestine to maybe a number approaching 80 or 90 in the congregation. And so in the year 2000, before the Intifada, we had two major congregational challenges before us. One, what to do with all the money you pilgrims were giving in the offering basket? And how do we seat so many people coming in each Sunday for worship? And so we devised where we had all these wonderful little stools that would suddenly appear in the aisle. And when I left, I think there may be at most of 30 people associated with the congregation, at most, probably more like well, 30. I mean, there was a good number, but this was a lot of friends of ours who were part of the congregation a larger way. So we had people that worked with NGOs, worked with diplomatic missions, and this is one of our favorite groups, Christian Peacemaker Team. They have a mission witness testimony in Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem. It's probably one of the most contested places of turf anywhere on the earth's surface. And what was so remarkable about their ministry, their presence, was that they had a kind of freedom from bitterness. That was remarkable, because keep in mind that if you live on the east side, if you work on sort of the Palestinian side of the street, who would you see, what kind of Israelis would you see? Well, you would see people, that Israelis that were committed to peace and justice. And those were people that were rolling away inch by inch, millimeter by millimeter, the stone. But you saw a lot of Israelis that were what you would say is the ugly Israeli, similar to the way we might speak about the ugly American. Israelis that would kick Palestinians, that would force young Palestinian men to sit in the hot sun on their feet with their hands handcuffed for hours and hours at a checkpoint. Israeli civil servants that would say, you don't have the right papers, come back in a month, and do that repeatedly. And so they were remarkable. They were from a variety of church traditions, and as you can see, from ages. And also, the previous picture, there were two black men. It was really nice also to have some diversity in terms of color as well. This is Hebron, the contested piece of turf that I told you about. When they have curfew, which they've had for, I think, well, probably the majority of time in the last 2 years, meaning for the majority of time you could not leave your apartment or house, could not leave it for any reason. And so here's a man, as we were walking around, we were with the Christian Peacemaker Team, we could walk in Hebron. This was on a Saturday, and also Jews who lived there. There are 400 settlers in the center of Hebron, which has a population in the whole Hebron area of 150,000 Palestinian Muslims. There are 400 Jewish settlers. They're protected by approximately 1,400 Israeli soldiers. That's a tremendous cost and tremendous stress. And so one of the things Christian Peacemaker Team does is walk children, Palestinian children, to school, because often they would be told either to walk in very circuitous routes up steep hillsides with no kind of walkway, or that sometimes Jewish settler kids would pelt them with rocks. And the soldiers would do nothing. Palestinians pelting anybody with any settler with rocks would get it quickly.
Well, the soldiers were there to protect the settlers, and their whole purpose for being there was to protect the settlers, so that's what they would.
And I'm going to have to leave now, but I just want to encourage you to at the very minimum, remember Palestinians and Israelis, Palestinian Muslims, Palestinian Christians, Israeli Jews, in your prayers, in the internationals, trying to work for a better sense of justice and peace, a real sense of justice and peace there. But that, please make that the minimum. And that's a kind of discipline, though, to pray daily for these people, because they so need our prayers. So thank you for coming. There are brochures and things that I'm just going to pass around. If anything catches your fancy, please keep it. Peace Center for the Blind is a charity that we supported, and this little magazine is just an example of how Palestinian culture is a very resilient culture as they try to go on. It just shows you what the activities and possibilities were in a normal week or month.
Just for the record, our congregation supports the Peace Center for the Blind.
Oh, really?
We've got
great
members who spent a year working there.
Oh, who is that?
Her name would have been Nancy
never like to be asked who.
No, sorry.
But I, Turnquist is her current name, Nancy Turnquist, but I think she would have been by her birth name, and that's what I'm working on.
Well, the woman who runs that is a wonderful Palestinian woman who is blind herself, and she's a group of, she's a Christian, and the women who come there are both Christian and Muslim, and they, Palestinians seem to have genetically that blindness is one of the weaknesses, physical weaknesses that they have. It seems like a greater percentage of blindness in the population. And for women who are blind, there's just really no future. You don't marry, you don't get educated, you pretty much just are kept at home. And like many handicapped people, in fact. So ministries that deal with handicapped people are very, very important there. The bishop's wife, Bishop Munib Yunan's wife, Suad, also works with the Helen Keller School, another school. And it's not just for blind, but also multiple handicapped children. And the idea that they're going to have another future is hopeful. It's really difficult, of course, for them now as well to imagine a future that's going to be receive these children. But in any case, these people just keep on working. And one day I realized, I guess it's just been hard for them for centuries, and so they just have learned to deal with it being hard and become more resilient. We're back in Hebron now, which is part of the West Bank Palestinian area, and this man on the right is a German journalist, and the woman on the left is a Roman Catholic. I can't tell. In either case, it's an old Roman Catholic activist. Either it's a man or a woman, and either it's a priest or a sister. Anyway, from the back, it's hard to tell. And they are walking around and visiting this vineyard that you can see is all dried up at the top. And the reason is that sometime during the night, Israeli settlers, radical people, these are people that are fanatics, came in and cut off the vines. You can see the two parts here. And here again, malice and desire to ruin people's livelihood and to make it difficult to stay there. And this is one of the things that the people have to live with and have to try to recover from. And again, as I said before, the policing of the Israeli Defense Forces in Hebron is to protect the settlers, not to protect the Palestinians around them. That's supposedly their own work. But of course, it's not very, very fair. This is just to contrast some of the hopefulness of 2000. I don't want you to go out of here. And this is the danger when we give these talks, I know, because it is hard to keep hope. But in the year 2000 was looked forward to as a time for especially the kind of brightening up of areas that would be tourist areas for Christians in particular. And Bethlehem seized that opportunity and had tremendous money poured in from many international agencies, governments, churches, and really, really became a wonderful looking city. It had been quite poor, and really was preparing for the pilgrims and the tourists who were going to be coming. And one of the programs that we did with the ELCJ that year was to something called Pentecost 2000, and this is on Manger Square in on Pentecost Sunday in the year 2000, and we have a crowd there. We are having a festival kind of gathering and celebrating. This is Manger Square in front of the Church of the Nativity, the traditional site of Jesus' birth. Just this past spring, it's a small group of internationals and Palestinians who have gathered for a peace prayers and a vigil, also on a Sunday evening. But the situation has changed dramatically since then, since the year 2000. Church leaders have had to take an unaccustomed sort of front line on some of these political concerns, and for the good of the people, for the good of the land. And it is really unusual to see a lineup of patriarchs from the traditional churches in the Holy Land together leading a protest march. This was an attempt in 2001, on New Year's Eve, for 2002, to try to go from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, to cross the checkpoint with this group of people. And the leaders, here's Bishop Muneeb Yunnan, here's a representative of the Greek Orthodox, here is the Latin Patriarch, the Roman Catholic representative, here's the Anglican bishop in Jerusalem. This is the Syrian Orthodox Patriarch. This is the Coptic Patriarch. And together they were making this stand. And here are Mitri Raheb, the Lutheran pastor in Bethlehem, and Jadal Shahada, the Lutheran pastor in Beit Zahor. They are neighboring, Beit Jala, not Beit Zahor, neighboring villages to Bethlehem. It was a wonderful attempt, and it was joined by many internationals, and the International Solidarity Movement had people there. There were a lot of people that had come out for this effort, but it was we were unable to get through.
Susan, in an event like that, would you ever get cooperation and participation
from
Jewish leaders?
Yes,
yeah.
From Rabbis for Human Rights. Rabbis for Human Rights were set on the other side in Jerusalem to greet us as we were coming.
Yeah.
So they were getting pressure from the Jerusalem side.
Yeah.
So that was the idea there. Yes,
and
it's very important
to
remember.
Even with all those public figures, they wouldn't let you through.
Here is, oh, sorry, let's see if I can get that back. Barbara Rossing, who some of you know, has been part of the Holden Village for many years, is a New Testament scholar at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, and she is here on the roof of the Lutheran Church of, Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem with Mitri Raheb, the pastor, with Viola Raheb, his sister, who is at the time was the director of the Lutheran schools, and their mother, who in Arabic would be Umitri, and the mother of Mitri. This was, again, a more hopeful time, around the time of Bethlehem 2000, and we were just having a nice time on the roof there with these wonderful people. Viola fell in love with another Palestinian who she met in Austria on one of her speaking tours. And she's a very articulate woman. Maybe some of you have heard her speak. This man is a classical Arabic music singer. And his family were refugees at the time of 1948 and moved to Lebanon. Refugees. refugees from Palestine, what became Israel. And they found love, and they hatched a plan that her husband-to-be would come to work with her in the school system, encouraging the cultural development of traditional Arabic music among the students. And in the town, there's a wonderful international center that is run by Christmas Lutheran Church, which tries to lift up joy and the art and ways to go along. And but as a refugee, despite their efforts, he was unable to be given permission by Israel to come back. And in fact, he was not given permission to come back for his wedding either.
Oh.
And so they arranged to have the wedding at the Lutheran Church in Amman, Jordan. And this is the pastor of that church in Amman. And so they are coming in to have this joyous, bittersweet celebration of new life and one more wonderful asset for the Palestinian people going away. They are now in Vienna, and I'm sure we'll speak and be very helpful in other ways, but unable to be so in their own country. Dancing, the dancing of the glorious, I mean the joy in the midst of a lot of trouble. People know how to celebrate, they really, really do, and it's a privilege to be with them when that happens. This is just a little glimpse of a Jaffa gate going into the old city of Jerusalem, and we're being checked by the soldiers along here. Some of the military vehicles. Here's a soldier checking. This again is in the earlier days when there were was a lot of traffic and a lot of more tourists. And there's a wall set up, and you can see people manage to get over walls no matter where they are. This was actually an Israeli art exhibit. An artist had put these odd blue climbing figures on the wall. They looked a little bit like crusaders. They looked a little bit like aliens. It was odd, but it was ironic. There's the figures going up. I mean, the reason to show this is just to again say how much a part of life was this constant coming up against walls. And the fact that we've not been able to get the technology to work during this time we've been here, it's just like Jerusalem. You always have to do something else than what you thought you were going to do. Again, a real checkpoint going toward Ramallah from Jerusalem. And the soldiers are over here to the left, and the people are trying to get through that to get to their homes or their relatives or their work or back from work. And Bishop Muneeb Younan arguing with the crossing police to let a group of ELCA delegates come through to visit Ramallah. And this time he was successful. And it took about half an hour of argument to get this group of dignitaries through to visit the pastor who had been under house arrest along with the rest of the city for a couple of months. This was during the time of the siege in Bethlehem and of Ramallah in the spring of 2002. And here is Pastor Ramez, the pastor of the Lutheran Church of Hope in Ramallah, and he is describing being used as a human shield by the IDF in Ramallah. He's an absolutely solid reporting source. There is no question that what he told us was true. And what had happened was that he was, at that point in time, the reason that the IDF was in Ramallah was to be searching for terrorists and for hidden weapons. That was the idea. In fact, what they did was...
What's IDF stand for, Susan?
The Israeli Defense Forces. And in fact, what they did, as we learned after they finally withdrew, was to demolish all kinds of infrastructure that was material as well as documentary. So many, the educational ministries, the banks, all kinds of places had all of their records destroyed, which, you know, if the whole purpose was to go in and find hidden weapons and terrorists, this is not what, in fact, was the result. Anyway, they, on the church door, since they knew that this was happening house to house, they had put a sign saying, "Do not break down the door. Call me, I will let you in." So that they would have done that in both Arabic and Hebrew and English, all of those languages, so that the soldiers would not damage the church needlessly. And so they did call him, and he came over. They came to get him, and then as they went into each room, they had their guns cocked and ready as they entered each room, and they pushed him in first, so that if there were indeed any terrorists in there, that he would be shot rather than they. And this was something that Israel categorically denied was happening. And it happened. We heard story after story after story during that time of this kind of a procedure from reputable people. And what happened then, he was not so afraid at this point, because he knew, of course, there were no terrorists in his church. There were no hidden caches of weapons. So this was not the scariest part, although he worried about about them getting trigger happy. What happened then was, after they had made sure that there was nothing in the church, they said, "All right, now you can go home." Now, the whole town was under curfew, and no one could be out on the streets. And if you were out on the streets, you could be shot. And he said, "You want me to walk home now during curfew?" And they said, "Oh yeah, yeah, go ahead. You know, we'll call ahead to the snipers or whoever, the Israeli snipers who are up on all the roofs looking around. You know, we'll do that." And so he had to walk home, hoping that he wasn't going to mistakenly be shot on the way. And there are many. We were with Bishop Muni Bunan one Sunday afternoon when this door-to-door searching. He used to be the pastor in Ramallah before becoming a bishop, and he was on the phone talking, and he has a speakerphone, so we could hear the voices as he was doing this. He was in one of these frameworks where he was calling 100 people, you know, trying to get something to happen. They were doing house-to-house searches, and he was calling particularly, he was concerned about one young man who lived with his impaired parents. One, his father was deaf, and his mother was mentally unstable. And he was very fearful that this young boy, just in his late teens, would not be able to handle that situation, and that the soldiers would come in, they would say something to the deaf father, he wouldn't hear them, and they would respond in a hostile manner, or that the mother would say something completely inappropriate that they would then respond to badly. And so he was encouraging this young man, say this. He gave him words in English to use. He called back repeatedly. And then the interesting thing was that even when the boy no longer answered the phone, he continued to call because he had told the boy to put the answering machine on the speakerphone so that the soldiers would hear that somebody was concerned about him, somebody knew what was going on, the bishop of the church was calling to find out, and while this was all going on. And then after about an hour, finally he called back, and indeed they had been there, everything had gone okay, but the kind of care and the kind of the ways that people have had to learn to work with that situation and use things like answering machines and cell phones and there are various ways. It's remarkable. It was a remarkable scene to be part of. This, and we're getting, I should probably just quickly go through the rest of these. This is a trip that was made to Jenin in the spring of 2002, also in you may have heard about the invasion of Jenin, again, considered to be a nesting of, a place that was a source of terrorists, and so the Israeli army went in, and this was the first convoy of relief aid that was allowed in after that. And you'll see this is one of the Syrian Orthodox priests is there filming it all as we are also taking pictures as we come in to this scene. Here are quilts done by if you've ever made quilts in your churches, these are Lutheran World Relief quilts coming off of the bus to a truck to try to shelter these people who have lost their homes that were bulldozed down. That quick picture was the Latin Patriarch again speaking with some of the people in the neighboring town, which was a Christian town, who had come to see him. This was what people were looking at in Jenin. A lot of devastation to their homes. Looked like an earthquake had happened, but it wasn't an earthquake. It was human beings going after one another. People trying to find some things in the rubble. Sandra Olein, who is leaning down speaking with these children, is presently working as an assisting pastor at the Christmas Church in Bethlehem. And she's a United Methodist pastor from the United States, but she's managed to work out this thing, which is actually remarkable because there are no women pastors in the ELCJ yet. And so that she has sort of been able to slip in there and function as a regular Palestinian congregation is really a tribute both to her and to Mitri Rahev, the other pastor, and to the congregation. Again, the resilience and the children, I mean, they've just been completely traumatized, and yet they can laugh. Just some friends and co-workers. Rima worked with us was a bookkeeper for the ELCJ for a while, and now is working at World Vision. She's a wonderful, gentle, competent woman, that we Palestinian woman. This is kind of in our neighborhood, our backyard area. Some children from the neighborhood and some sheep grazing in the back there on the Mount of Olives. This is Samir Saeed, who catered our farewell luncheon at church this year, and has a falafel stand on Christian Road, and is a Lutheran. Here we got to know Manuel very, very well. he's the KLM agent, and we were doing a lot of flying back and forth during the time that we were there, and he was always extraordinarily helpful. His brother, who was really the owner and manager of this office, had left on the same plane that Michael did in June to start a new life in America. This is Palm Sunday, the beautiful weaving of palm branches into these lovely constructions of little baskets, woven baskets, and then people place flowers in the baskets and they do their Palm Sunday marches from the Mount of Olives down or through the streets of the Old City. Here is the Palm Sunday march this past year, coming down the Mount of Olives from Bethany, trying to retrace the route of Jesus going toward the city of Jerusalem. Again, here you see Sandra and these children. It's not a great picture exactly, but Sandra is over here. Sandra Olein, who is the assisting pastor in Bethlehem. And then these children are from the Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. The remarkable thing is they had never been to Jerusalem before, 6 miles away. And somehow she managed that Sunday to get them in as a group to do Palm Sunday, the Palm Sunday march, the ecumenical march down the mountain. And they were astonished to be there.
This was 2002 now?
This was this year. This was 2003.
Three, okay.
Yeah. This is a Good Friday. We're coming Palm Sunday, Good Friday. Again, it's something that's very unusual. This is the cooperative Anglican Lutheran early morning walk on the Way of the Cross, the Via Dolorosa. And the last stations, if you're in a regular worshiping group that is not part of the traditional churches that have the six churches who have access to worship within the Holy Church of the Holy Sepulcher, where the last three stations of the Via Dolorosa are, then you have to, we have had to have those final three stations of prayer outside and then into the Church of the Redeemer, which is adjacent to that holy site. Anyway, what's remarkable about this is that here are three Palestinians. This is an Anglican priest. This is Ramez again, who had gotten in from Ramallah this year. It was a moment of more freedom at that point. And then to have a young Palestinian girl carrying the cross was remarkable. That had never happened before either. Things do continue to change, and there's small hope. Again, of the crowd that had gathered for that walk, close to the Church of the Redeemer. Church of the Redeemer is on the left over there.
Is this along the Via Dolorosa?
Mm-hmm. One of the years that we walk the Via Dolorosa on Good Friday, we do it early in the morning at 6, and with this group. One morning we came around the corner at one of those Good Friday mornings at the Church of the Redeemer, and one of the bread bakers had set out his bread. And whether intentionally or not, it was in this form of the cross. And it was such a lovely picture of the bread of life on that morning. The Swedish photographer who was with us took this wonderful photograph, which is the photograph of her photograph, so it's not as good quality as the photograph actually is. This is Easter morning on the Mount of Olives, the resurrection celebration, which continues to be sought and hoped for again in the situation there, the hope that the stone will indeed be rolled away for the people there who are suffering greatly and are greatly constricted in a tomb-like, a dead-end situation and who need to call on all of us to try to help to open and roll away those stones. This is an important, excuse me, I've got two more here. Let me just then go back here. This is another sign of hope. This is a house just outside of the main populated area of Jerusalem. It's a Palestinian house that had been built and destroyed three times because They had tried over and over and over, the Palestinian owners had tried over and over and over to get permission to build. And the way that the bureaucracy works, they can build, there are always many, many, many more housing units going up for Israeli Jews, and very, 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 very seldom is a Palestinian given permission to build. Therefore, for whatever, all kinds of legal loophole, wrong signature, I mean, any number of things that makes it almost impossible bureaucratically for a Palestinian to get permission to build. Now, their families grow. They need more space. They need homes. And so they will build without a permit. And then, depending, you know, they take their chances. And sometimes then the bulldozers come and just knock down their building on, and their, all of the money that they've put into it is lost. This house, this family had tried every, had gone through every bureaucratic thing that was thrown at them over this course of time. Built, demolished, built, demolished, built, demolished. And this is a group of internationals, Palestinians, and rabbis for human rights, and Israelis against housing demolitions gathered together for the rebuilding of this house yet again. It is true that that kind of rebuilding is a huge sign of hope. And finally, these three boys at the, earlier you saw the small group of people gathered in front of the Church of the Nativity on Major Square. And they were part of that, a little larger group. And they're holding a poster, End the Illegal Occupation of Palestine, which is actually a Lutheran World Federation poster. This has been taken on as a task, a mission, something that we as Lutherans worldwide are to be involved in whatever ways we can. This is a Lutheran agenda before you. I've seen it as that important. So, thank you. I think that's the end of what time we have, and hope that we can.
Question.
In
all the settings I've been in this, the Israeli establishment consistently comes off as abusers, cruel, and the Palestinians exclusively as hapless victims.
No,
is it that black and white?
Victims. No, they are not. And I'm sorry if that's been the impression we've given. And I have to say that we...
Not just you. Every setting I've been in.
Well, okay. Every time you've been at one? Well...
And, you know, with you folks and with others, it's... it just comes across that way.
They aren't hapless victims, but they are surely victims. I mean, they've certainly done their part to increase the seriousness of the situation, and have done terrible. The suicide bombings are just the worst thing that that could happen, and that people are willing to do that is a sign of their desperation. But it's also something that has to be roundly condemned, they aren't hapless victims. There's a lot of, there are people who are corrupt, people who have mixed motives, people who are not looking for the greater good among the Palestinian people. But I will say that the power differential is so great,
yes,
that it's hard not to be a victim. I mean, for
I think
the
Palestinian,
it's so... and to present, when you're trying to present something that is, you know, you don't know for sure if people have any idea of what kind of oppressive life people are living under, then, you know, it's likely that people who have experienced that, who have seen it, are going to come back and really want to tell that story, because
yes.
they don't think people are hearing it, you know, or have seen it. So, yes.
I think a seldom mentioned aspect is if, for instance, you and I were at odds with each other and we're at this moment trying to get reconciled, and a couple of my pals were over here throwing rocks at you
uh-huh.
on my behalf, it would be hard for you to be sympathetic to what I was trying to reach out. I think that the Palestinians, in many cases, are really striving towards unity, but we have the Aqsa Brigade and Hamas and Hezbollah that are lobbying actual bombs and sending suicide bombers over, just undoing every
mm-hmm.
bit of advancement that's made.
Yes, it's really true. I mean, anybody, in the way that the negotiating has been going, especially, and this is really important, especially when limits are placed before negotiation, that there has to be a period of calm, and that it's 3 months, two, you know, one, whatever it's set, that gives the chance to any extremist to go in there and ruin it.
Yes.
You know, just go in there and do something so that it won't proceed. And this is giving a whole lot of power to the extreme people.
Well, the people setting the, putting the, you know, the conditions really don't want the peace either.
Yes.
I think Ariel Sharon is
like.
More responsible
yes.
than anybody else for the Intifada.
It's what it starts to seem like, yeah.
That heavy-handed
yeah.
maneuver he did going up to the
yeah.
mosque.
Yeah. It was definitely a political step, and it wasn't just... wasn't going to worship. However,
I've got to say, though, that, you know, I've talked to a lot of Christians who have spent some amount of time in the Middle East, and every one of them sounds like this, and they're telling the truth. It's not that they've had blinders put on, it's that our press does not provide us with anything resembling a balanced view, and so they need to tell the story on behalf.
That's what I was going to say. I just appreciate what you're doing here. And the pictures say so much, as well as you, about the truth of what's happening and how we need to be informed. And we aren't through our press. And this has been so important, I think, what you do.
If you'd like to sign your name here to get, we're willing to send out by email any some websites that might give you some more of that kind of information. You probably signed it already.
I signed it yesterday.
If some of you didn't get a chance and have email and would like to get sent a list of kind of alternative sources to the usual news.
Are the American Jews also exacerbating the difficulties?
The American Jews don't know what's going on in the... Really, I have to say, I mean, our 13-year-old son, when we moved to Hanover, New Hampshire in the fall, he went to class, and he has a little girl, and little 13-year-old girl, and a lot of Jewish people live in that area, and this girl's in his class, and she, Leah, basically told him. You don't know what's going on. I'm Jewish. I know. But because she was Jewish, what she said had an authority way beyond an eyewitness authority.
In her own mind.
In her own mind. And in the mind of the community, basically.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, the American public just has information that is so slanted, for the most part, in our mass media.
Well, it's slanted and it's not. I mean, you have to learn. I have a wonderful, good article here about words without meaning. For instance, when you hear the word gunfights and clashes, and you hear the word disputed territory, and you hear the word occupation, I mean, what do these things mean? You have to translate. You have to interpret what those words mean when they're used in a newspaper. You need to know what they mean. Gunfight. Let me just read this very quickly. This is very impressive. Okay, on Monday the 7th. This is from Nablus, which is in the West Bank. On Monday the 17th of February, I stood in the midst of what would have been reported in the media as a gunfight between the Israeli army and Palestinian fighters. This was indeed a clash. At 2 p.m. in the heart of Nablus's shopping district, with children making their way home from school and hundreds of civilians going about their daily business, at least two Israeli tanks and a fleet of armored personnel carriers unexpectedly entered the city, shooting randomly at buildings and people on the streets. Members of the Nablus's armed resistance returned fire from the street and apartment windows. Young men threw stones at the tanks and jeeps. Meanwhile, businessmen frantically tried to lock up their shops in fear of tank fire destroying their windows, and men, women, and children fled to the cobbled streets of the old city where the army vehicles hadn't entered. Ambulances rushed from casualty to casualty with trails of blood leading the way. Two medical workers were injured. One was an ambulance driver who, shot in the hand, continued his work for the rest of the day bandaged in serious pain. The other was a young man on his first day as a volunteer with the medical relief team. A bullet came through the side of the ambulance, and this young man is now without his testicles. A 20-year-old man took 6 bullets in his body. A 12-year-old boy crossing the street to his mother lost half of his face to an exploding bullet. Who designed such things? He now has no nose, no cheekbone, and half a mouth. The news reports 22 people were injured today in clashes in the West Bank. One man hears a tank rolling down the street towards his car. He makes a split-second decision to try to rescue his car. Realizing the futility of this effort, as the tank turns a corner into the street, he crosses to the other side, abandoning the vehicle. Unarmed and unthreatening, maybe he didn't expect to be the target of an Israeli bullet. Seconds later, his brains were sliding down a shuttered doorway while his car was crushed into the asphalt. And the news report is, 4 Palestinians died today during a gunfight on the streets of Nablus. When you hear those terms, you need to understand that there's, as you do, I know you do, that there's a telling of the quote facts and a telling of the story.
When there's a suicide bomber, we're always told exactly how many people have died.
And sometimes their names.
And I just started paying attention a little bit to the people that are killed by Israeli forces. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the numbers get reported, but you have it's like 50 to 1, isn't it? I mean,
no, actually, like amazingly, given that power differential, there is, it's more like a 4-3 to 1.
Yeah.
And that's very worrisome to Israel, in fact, because at the beginning, the first year of the Intifada, it was a much higher percentage, 10 to 1.
Yeah.
And now it's been coming down. See, so the Palestinians have become more clever.
Yeah, Susan.
Thank you so much for
taking
your